Hey, Chris Manning here, one of the hosts of Locked On Cavs. Coming up on today's show, Evan and I are going to talk about the Return of the King preface and the first two chapters of that book. Every Friday we're going to be doing the book club. At the end of the show, you'll also hear a little compilation you've heard from our friends at Rejecting the Screen, hosted by Noah Kozlov and Adam Stanko. We're just going to put that in there. You might want to go check that out in terms of one of the great shows in the network, so please check that out at the end of today's show, and we're gonna hop right into the book club right after this.
You are Locked On Cavaliers, your daily Cleveland Cavaliers podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Cleveland Cavaliers select Darius Garland from Vanderbilt University.
Cleveland! This is for you!
Evan, what's going on, buddy? How are you doing as we continue our over a month now without actual real new basketball stuff to talk about?
I'm hanging in there. I'll just catch up on shows. Some shows I like are coming back. Shout out to What We Do in the Shadows. Great movie by Taika Waititi, and an even better show. And you redid the cold open and you talked about Return of the King, and I want to make Lord of the Rings jokes throughout this because I did watch Lord of the Rings over the weekend. So this will be a fun talk. How are you doing, buddy?
You know, Lord of the Rings, I'm deep into Animal Crossing.
Of course. Bunny Day's over.
Yeah, I was enraptured by I don't know if you saw the Elijah Wood playing Animal Crossing thing that went around on Twitter. That was pretty great.
Topical.
Pretty funny. Speaking of Lord of the Rings. You know, that's actually one of my cultural blind spots. I've never watched a Lord of the Rings movie nor read one of the Lord of the Rings books.
Chris, you'd love them.
I know, and it's on my list. It's something I keep telling myself I'm going to do, but then I keep, like, Hustlers was 99 cents on Apple this week, so I rented that. That movie's just a load of fun.
Have you seen Hustlers before, though?
Yes.
So, you got no excuse here. You're spending money to watch something you've already seen when...
That's true, and I'm literally, as I turn my head right now, you listeners can't see this because audio podcasts are a famously visual medium, but I have a Lord of the Ring box set that I got when I was like 8 years old from my dad that I've read part of The Hobbit. I took it to work like a month ago before this started, and... Yeah, I'm gonna read that. I'll give updates intermittently. Even if it's not on the podcast, I'll give updates. But that's gonna be something we're have to cover there.
Good. The Hobbit's my favorite book of all time, besides, you know, the book the listeners picked for us to read along and actually listen to. So I have some thoughts on that as well. But
you went audiobook.
I did the audiobook.
Yeah, I went old school with the print. Let's start with the preface, Evan. For me, I think, you know, there's a really good story in this. People that have read it or listened to it in whatever, however you're consuming this book. I want to say, I think the story that RJ tells in this beginning, Richard Jefferson tells in the beginning, is great. I just want to say, if I was thinking about getting a player to write a book about this team, there's no one I would rather have other than Richard Jefferson, aside from maybe Channing Frye. But, like, LeBron would be too on the nose. Kevin Love, I don't know if you're going to get something as candid as this. You know, Kyrie would just be like, here, I'm going to draw like a symbol of our united chakras. And RJ wrote a really, really great, as told to however he, you know, did this. I thought it was great. And I think it's a really good tone setter to a very fun book.
No, I totally agree. For those listening, I do sometimes like to listen to audiobooks and to mix it up from podcasts, like when I'm working and everything, just, you know, change of pace. And I was reading Ethan Strauss's book, I was listening to it, and I don't know, man, maybe it's just the sweet monotone tones of Brian Windhorst reading to me for what ended up being about 8 hours, I think, for the entire book. It's a fun story. It's just a weird team in one of the craziest years, obviously, in Cleveland sports history. And no, like you said, I think RJ is probably the best guy for it. And I cracked a joke when he said LeBron, like Lee Jenkins would write it for him. Like Kyrie would be like goofy. Maybe. Yeah, but no, like I think RJ is just like really well said. Like I really enjoyed it. It was just a lot of fun. And yeah, it was a really good preface to overall just a fun book. And It was also a fun trip down memory lane. I was texting you while I was listening to it about things I wanted to touch on, and we'll probably touch on this later, but like, I forgot some of the weird stuff David Blatt did when he was head coach of the Cavaliers.
Yeah, there's Blatt stuff here in chapter two that we'll get into that it reads a certain way, which we'll talk about in the next segment there. But the Blatt stuff comes through a lot in this. But I think to just touch on like where we start here in with the preface, and we'll get into chapter one. I thought this was the quote that stuck out to me, and this sentiment from Richard that was really the crux. Aside from the really great story about how they almost misplaced the Larry O'Brien Trophy on the day of the parade, which would just stress me the F out.
Imagine being the guy who had to haul the Larry O'Brien Trophy through that crowd and like the chaos, because Cleveland, like, I can't remember if RJ touched on it or if Brian Windhorst and Dave McManaman did, but like Cleveland wasn't equipped for a championship parade because they haven't had one in so long. Like, they had no barriers or guardrails really anywhere. So like that trophy could have gotten destroyed on the trip to Channing.
Oh, there's a lot of bleak outcomes with this. And then like the whole thing, I think what Richard talks about in this about the retirement speaks to like how stressful like this is when you get to the highest level, you know? And you know, luckily he didn't retire, and because we got more entertainment out of him. But you know, I mean, I remember that happening, and I was like, "Oh, that sucks." But you know, it's good that he came back. But here's the quote: It doesn't mean you had to be best friends. It doesn't mean all 15 guys have to be out there together at every dinner. It doesn't mean you have to match personalities. No one can match my personality anyway. Come on, let's be real. And it goes into this dynamic about how it's about being able to trust each other and being able to count on the guy to do his job in these situations. And when he talks about that, and he also ends up talking about like how much the 2016 title clearly meant to him, these guys, for him, just kind of all the stuff with his career and how it played out. Like, it just reminds you how special this title was. I think we've been there's been so much great 2016 look back content for among Cavs people. You know, we're doing it. Our friends at the Chase Down did it. Other people have written about it in the sense, you know, it's always going to be something I think we revisit a lot. And, you know, I think it's something we very clearly understand. But this is, for whatever reason, something that really gets the chills going for me a little bit in terms of how crazy this all was and how much it meant. And I don't get that from everything that I'm consuming with that title. But for some reason, this intro and what Richard gets into in this, it really hits that home for me.
I think just like the biggest thing of all is RJ's mind was made up at that point where like he was going to retire on top. And I still wonder, like, maybe it was just like the heat of the moment where because he announced at the championship parade that he was coming back for another season. And just like, maybe it was the heat of the moment, maybe it was the fans, but like, it's special because you have guys like Richard Jefferson, who has played for a lot of different teams and he's played for a lot of different fan bases, but I know if like him and Channing, especially like Cleveland, will be the one that always has like the most special place in their heart. And that just says a lot. And I think maybe the fans did play a factor in talking about a retirement and just like, yeah, no, it's an excellent book. And I hope those of you who are listening, who, especially if you voted for this, read along, because Chris and I make these sacrifices for you, the listeners.
Well, also you have Richard, like, you know, we don't get the later quote of like, I'm going to sacrifice my way out of here. There's a lot of like Richard stuff we don't get unless he, you know, comes back and stuff. Okay. Chapter one.
Exactly.
This book is obviously about the 2016 title and LeBron.
There's a lot of prefacing on how this team was, how they got to this point,
which is very important. There's a lot of stuff that like all coalesces. We'll get into it. I just want to say, I feel a little bit for Z because, you know, he chose not to be interviewed for the book and that kind of stuff. I mean, I'm sure a lot of this information Wendy's getting from different people, or maybe Z's telling us, but he's not going on the record. There's very few Zdeněk Zlogowski's interviews of the last like 5 years, which it doesn't surprise me from what I've heard about him kind of being a more reserved guy at this point and not like really kind of going with where to talk a bunch. But when I think about this and him not being quoted and like the long-standing friction between him and Dan that's kind of fleshed out here a little bit, and how his jersey retirement was about him but also not about him, that reminds me that like the Cavs have been oriented around LeBron James for like 20 years at this point. And you do that obviously because he's an all-time great, arguably the best player that has ever played professional basketball. But you kind of feel for a little bit for Z in this, just thinking about this, because like his jersey retirement is is more or less like a way to help recruit LeBron back, even if it is something that was going to happen. They did it at the time to help recruit back LeBron James.
Yeah. First off, I was at that game, actually. I watched the Cavs lose to the Knicks, and you know, they sullied a overall just special night because the halftime performance was great, just the ceremony in general. But if you really think about it, like, first off, like you said, yeah, it's a shame that the Cavs like had a hidden agenda in commemorating one of the best players in franchise history in Z and retiring his number 11. But LeBron does strike me as a dude who's corny enough to watch a jersey retirement ceremony and watch the Cavs go all out to at least generate interest. Like, I do think that's a possibility, but at the same time, I just think LeBron is so hyper obsessed with his legacy that I feel like Cleveland was seriously in the play no matter what. And I think more so what Pat Riley and the Heat did more or less push LeBron out the door more so than what Dan and the Cavs were doing, because especially after that letter, I thought there's no coming back from this ever. And especially after they rehired Mike Brown and LeBron was a free agent, I'm like, there's definitely no way they're coming back from this ever. So I don't know. I mean, I guess it's a nice sentiment and maybe that did start the conversation, but I don't know. Maybe I don't know if LeBron's really like Jimmy Butler, because as we all know, Jimmy Butler wanted to go to Miami because he was watching, I think, Dwayne Wade's either his jersey retirement or like his retirement tour. And he was so touched by the entire experience and how the fans were going crazy that he had to be a part of hashtag Heat culture. So I don't know if LeBron's that corny, but at the same time, I also wouldn't be surprised if he like he's like, you know what? Yeah, that was pretty cool. Like, I want that.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And then there's a little note, two things about Z's kind of end that I think suck. I think it sucks he got booed. His final kind of stat line for that year in Miami, which was the last year of his career, 5 points, four boards a game, 15.9 minutes per game, a slightly negative 0.2 value over replacement. Also, I just want to say long live the plain dealer. Long live the union that has been busted by Advanced Local, unfortunately. Z took out a full page ad in the PD at that time when he leaves, and that's just my that's one of my favorite athlete cliche things, is take out the ad in the paper. And again, this is like a decade later when the plain dealer is just unfortunately and we're worse off for no longer what it was. The other thing, Evan, that I just found myself laughing reading is the Cavs, Chris Grant's like capstone his plan is like, we're going to sign some veterans. And this is like credited as like a Chris Grant, a Chris Grant plan to bring LeBron back. They're like, okay, we're going to hire Mike Brown. Okay. We're going to get some veterans, improve, make a push for the playoffs. So we're going to sign Andrew Bynum. We're going to sign Earl Clark and Jarrett Jack. And then after he's fired, it's trades for Luol Deng and Spencer Hawes that David Griffin does. And the Hawes one's really the most effective acquisition of those. But like, none of those guys are on the team a year later. Not a single one of them is in Cleveland for more than a season. And that is incredible. This was like the culmination of them trying to take the next step, and it just totally blew up in their face.
No, it really was. And it's kind of fascinating because hearing that again, I laughed. And first off, I have to say, Windhorst was wrong. Z wasn't booed in LeBron in the Heat's first game back in Cleveland. They cheered for him and then immediately cut back to boos and introducing the rest of the team, because I think the starting lineup was Z, Chris Bosh, Carlos Arroyo, LeBron, and Dwayne Wade. It's really sad that I forgot this, because I watched the clip after he said it. I'm like, I don't remember them booing Z. They didn't boo Z. But Chris Grant was a fucking moron when it came. Like, he was ambitious for sure, but goddamn, it is incredible. Like, it is current Cavs, like, to watch free agent acquisitions of Jarrett Jack, who at the time made sense because I think he was coming from Golden State, and I envisioned like maybe they would do what they did with him and Steph. Like, yeah, I guess that works, whatever. Sure, man. If it's weird if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. I thought the Andrew Bynum thing was like a high risk, possibly high, maybe like 5% chance, high reward. Obviously didn't work out, and shout out to the legendary shot chart of Andrew Bynum's last practice with the Cavs, still one of my favorite pictures online. And finally, Earl Clark was such a blip on the radar that, and like such a, just like a flash in the pan kind of thing, that like completely unremarkable and like just bad in his time with Cleveland. And I feel like we know we make a case for number three being bad, but like number six is seared in my brain as like a curse number with the Cavs just because of Earl Clark. And then, like you said, like Spencer Hawes was a racist, but a good acquisition for the Cavs by David Griffin. And Luol Deng did not care when he came here.
No, he wanted no part of it.
Not at all. Fun fact about a young Evan, he bought a Luol Deng jersey after he got traded here because he was so excited.
Oh, buddy.
That's like my Andrew Wiggins jersey purchase. It's like my defending Deion Waiters for the longest time. It's just like, I'm a masochist. Like, I love to be hurt. But I'm like the Browns on draft night. We're recording this on draft night, so people know. Like, it's that Michael Scott Beamer. It's like, okay, well, I'm ready to be hurt again. So it's just fascinating that the Cavs had to give up pieces to just shed off contract, because I think we're going to touch on this in a minute. Like, Rich and LeBron are playing fucking hardball. They said, all right, sign us to the maximum possible contract, or we are not entertaining having any discussions with you. And basically, they put the gun to the Cavs' head, and that's kind of a theme of the second LeBron era in Cleveland, is Rich Paul had Dan Gilbert, David Griffin by the balls, because he's a shrewd negotiator. And kids, if you're somehow a prospective NBA player, sign with Rich Paul. He'll take good care of you throughout your entire NBA career.
As we wrap up the first chapter here, do you remember where you were when Chris Grant got fired?
I think I was in one of my classes in college. So all a bit of a blur at this time in my life, because with age, you lose your memory at 27 years old. I think I was just in class in college, and I was just like, they suck anyway. I'm like, I don't know who this David Griffin guy is, but then I learned David Griffin plays this card so close to his chest, he's practically wearing them. So it became stressful after that. Where were you when
I was also in a college class, and Trevor Magnotti texted me I was like goofing off. I wasn't really, it was like a 101 class that I was like sort of not really paying attention in. I think it was Psych 101. And
nice.
Trevor texted me the link to the Woj bomb, and I just started laughing, and the kid next to me was like, what are you laughing about? And I was just
Yahoo Woj at the time?
Yeah, this would have been Yahoo Woj at the time. I also can tell you where, when Spencer Hollins was acquired by the Cavs, I was waiting to go into a 9 a.m. class that I couldn't look at any my phone or anything during that time. So I was like panic texting Trevor, like, dude, can you just post on this real quick, back when we were running the Cavs fan-sided blog. That was a weird year. That was just one of the weirdest years of my life thinking about that Cavs team.
Yeah, no, that was just a weirdly frustrating and disappointing team in general, because I was a lot more casual as a basketball fan back then. And actually, I'm a bold-faced liar. I was working and living in Indiana at the time, so I had to watch the Cavs on illegal streams because Fox Sports like Go really wasn't a thing yet. Yeah, no, I was just really mad and really just kind of frustrated and disappointed by those Cavaliers, because I thought, like, okay, they're gonna take the step. They made the moves. Kyrie's legit. I'm tired of people telling me he's not legit. Like, and then it just, you know, it all fell apart in spectacular fashion.
Yeah,
but okay, those teams also have, like, a bit of a soft spot in my heart still for some reason.
Yeah, it's a weird season. I think some of the weird stuff I definitely have some good memories of in some ways. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, come back, and then talk about chapter 2 of the book. We'll be right back. All right, we are back here, Evan and I, talking about chapter 2 of Return of the King. The whole story about how the Cavs get LeBron back and win the 2016 NBA title. This chapter gave me whiplash.
Mm-hmm.
No, there's so much going on in this chapter that tells us about David Griffin, that tells us about Dan Gilbert, that tells us about what was going to come with Kyrie, with David Blatt. Like, there's just a lot going on here. Where do you want to start?
Where do we start? Let me ask you a broad question before we really get into the nitty gritty. Do you think, how much blame, how culpable do you think Dredrick Irving is in Kyrie wanting to leave Cleveland?
I mean, it has to have some impact. I have no idea to tell you exactly how much it is, but I think it's clearly something. You know, I think that someone clearly was close to Kyrie. But I think when I read this chapter, Evan, when I think about this, it is, mm-hmm. They go out of their way to talk about how Griff was trying to forge a bond with Kyrie and sell him on what they were doing. And we think about how Kyrie left. It's after David Griffin, in a similar position to this, like he's trying to like here we talk about Griff trying to establish his power. He doesn't take the GM job right away, and Chris Grant is fired. He waits. He ends up getting hired. They don't agree on who the coach is going to be. Gilbert's guy is Blatt. You have Griff favoring Ty Lue. They end up kind of setting a sort of a agreement to kind of try to bring both guys in. Griff gets to keep control on the roster, which according to this book, you know, he might not have, depending on who else they might have gone after. And yeah, you know, it's like Calipari or something like that. And then,
an option.
Yeah. And you go into all of this and it's like trying to forge his relationship with Kyrie and kind of make sure that's working. And we see what falls out. And like, when I just think about that, it's just like, I think we have a what if week coming up in the network. And I think one of the biggest what ifs is just, you know, if David Griffin's still around, would it have been easier to kind of calm Kyrie down and bring him back that summer? I think that it's unknowable. You know, I don't even know what Griff would say to that if we were to post him that question, but it just feels so important to me that Griff was a guy that could kind of relate to Kyrie and went out of his way to bond with him after Kyrie already was a little fluky on kind of how things had gone the first couple years of his career.
Yeah, no, I think it's, I mean, obviously the smart thing to do is like you try and be on good terms with the best player in the franchise. And I think when LeBron expressed interest in returning, the power of hindsight, people have said, look, Kyrie wasn't on board with that. And I feel like Griff was trying to maintain that delicate balance between, like, you know, keeping Kyrie happy because, shout out to the Chase Down Boys, but when they had Jason Lloyd on their show, like, I guess Lloyd and Dave McMenamin at the time, and even Windhorst was saying, like, Kyrie's a weird fucking dude. And, like, Griff probably was reading the tea leaves a little bit and noticed that, like, Kyrie's just is different, and if you got to keep him happy to keep things calm and peaceful, like, that's the smart thing to do. And it's just weird to think, like, there's a lot of what-ifs in this scenario, because I'm pretty certain the Jazz would have matched if Cleveland made an offer to Gordon Hayward, but I do wonder if LeBron decided to re-up one more year with Miami. We're looking at a team, a David Black coach team, where we have, because Kevin Love wasn't going to come in unless LeBron was coming, so then we'd have a David Black coach team of Kyrie, Dion, Wiggins, Hayward, Thompson, Varejao, and Bennett, and like Sergei Karasev and Tyler Zeller, like all these young pieces for Cleveland. And obviously we wouldn't be having the conversation about the 2016 team like we have, but no, Griff was instrumental and is a hell of a GM, and New Orleans got super lucky. And I think, not I think, I know, looking back, like, besides the letter, I think one of Dan Gilbert's biggest mistakes as owner of this team is letting Griff walk away over a petty squabble over how much money he should be making.
Yeah, David Griffin has aged the best out of any of the non-player characters of this book in this era of Cavs basketball. Evan, here I'm going to run you through all of the coaches, the Cavs, that were mentioned to be linked to during this time, or coaches that the Cavs have courted at some point. And there's a lot of them. So here we go. John Calipari, Tom Izzo, Bill Self, who David Griffin, and I would love to know if Dan Gilbert told him to do this, asked him, they offered him, he showed up to shout Wiggins and Embiid at Kansas, and he offers him the job sort of on the spot, engages interest on the spot. Craziness. Steve Kerr, who goes to the Warriors this year, is on that radar, which is a really crazy sliding doors moment. Alvin Gentry is mentioned as a name. You know, there's Coach K is someone that they contacted, which is kind of insane.
To be fair though, Dan's white whale before John Boeheim was a college coach. So like
The John Boeheim mistake coaches. Was certainly, I think, an inevitability with the Cavs. And I think this book is a reminder of that. But then you get into Steve Kerr and Ty Lue David Blatt and Lue. Which one of the names that don't end up getting hired by the team interests you the most? I think for me, it's actually Kerr, because I think it's just a really interesting thing where it's like he goes to Cleveland and maybe the Warriors hire Blatt because he was going to go there. Like Blatt was going to go there before he got the Cavs job to work on their Kerr staff. I just don't know. But I it's one of those like kind of weird sliding doors moments.
I'm Googling it right now to see. Oh my God. This will be 2014. Sorry, I'm just dragging this out of it. I would pick Steve Kerr too, but I don't know if Steve Kerr would work in Cleveland, especially if LeBron came back, because Steve Kerr is so hell-bent and determined on doing his way that like it worked for what Golden State's trying to do. And obviously, like, Kevin Durant threw the wrench in that thing when he started playing ISO ball to carry the Warriors in the playoffs. But like, LeBron would not fly with that. Maybe he would respect the fact that like Kerr is a Phil Jackson disciple who has been successful, or one, incredibly lucky to play for the Bulls and the Spurs, but two, has been successful in every place that he's been. But I don't know. That's an interesting question. And now I'm looking at the list for the Warriors. The options were not David Blatt, I don't think, but obviously Kerr, Stan Van Gundy, Alvin Gentry, Lionel Hollins, Fred Hoiberg, Tom Thibodeau, and Mike D'Antoni. Those were the serious candidates for the job. So
Hoiberg,
yeah, just a bit. Gentry, I guess. That's the thing, though, because I really can't make a case for, like, Gentry was an assistant in Golden State, and so was Luke Walton as his assistant in Golden State. But, like, you want to give Steve Kerr some credit for, like, you know, gutting it out with, like, really solid bench rotations and smart coaching. But when he was out with that back injury and, like, the Warriors absolutely crushed it, and Luke Walton was able to land the Lakers job likely because of that, because he just pointed to that record and said, like, look what I did as a head coach with the best team in the NBA, like, the team wasn't being coached. They were just going out there and playing pickup, basically, and just fucking around, and they dominated for that record. But just to get back to your question, like, out of all those candidates, like, I would have been fine with Alvin Gentry. Like, Alvin Gentry is, like, a harmless coach. Like, Ty Lue, obviously, is the right answer here, and that ends up being the right answer in this book you come to learn. But, no, I think I'd go with Kerr if I didn't have to, if you wouldn't, didn't let me pick Ty, I'd pick Steve Kerr.
Yeah, in the non-high category, I think Kerr is just the interesting one. You know, he takes a lot of flack and a lot from Worcester, but I think highly of Kerr as a coach and kind of a culture setter. But, you know, we don't know these things. Gentry is another one who I think would have been an interesting pick. Ty obviously ends up being the most kind of, they don't win a title without Ty, and it's one of those things where we don't know how that sort of works. But it's just all the coaches and the insanity around that coaching search a year after they brought back Mike Brown. It's just like a very funny thing. Griff wanted to go offensive and stuff like that. It's just pretty funny. The other thing that I was reminded of is that Jabari Parker apparently tanked his workout with the Cavs.
I completely forgot about that. And then, like, Andrew Wiggins rightfully hates the Cavs because they kind of just, like, kept him in limbo for the longest time. Like, I felt bad listening to that again because I'm just like, oh, Jesus, the Cavs really, like, hung this kid out the dry for the longest time, and now
yes,
he is with the Golden State Warriors, which is weird to say. And whatever, man, like, he's gonna get traded because the Warriors love having bad contracts on their team at all times, I guess. So I don't know what they're gonna do there, but that's a story for another day. But no, like, I forgot Jabari tanked his workout, and I think at the time of the draft, even this is before really LeBron coming back was, like, in my mind, because I was just convinced, like, he's going to re-up with Miami. Like, he's not going to come back. Like, just move on. Like, I wanted the Cavs to hit Joel Embiid really bad. Like, injury concerns aside, I'm like, okay, he can just rehab with the Cleveland Clinic and their medical, and the Cavs medical staff is, like, the tops in the league. Like, bring Embiid in. And I do wonder what could have been if the Cavs didn't take Wiggins instead of Embiid. Like, we're doing a lot of what-ifs at this point. Like, I think Wiggins instead of Embiid would definitely be intriguing going forward, especially like a 1-2 punch of Kyrie and Embiid would be a lot of fun. And yeah, no, it's just, there's a lot of just, it was like a weird and weirdly stressful time, like, leading up to, like, LeBron coming back to the Cavs, because, yeah, I don't know, just a lot of just, like you said, it was insane. Like, there's so much going on behind the scenes, and then, like, retelling all of it, it's like, holy shit, the Cavs had to jump through hoops while walking on their hands, and the hoops are on fire just to try and entertain LeBron enough to get him to come back to Cleveland.
Yeah. You see in this that they, like, obviously were, they shut down, they move heaven and earth and call things off with Gordon Hayward to get LeBron back. And once, dude, LeBron is like, hey, we're open, and you do that in 10 out of 10 times. But it's so interesting that they had this plan to try to lure him back, and then they sort of wavered on that. I don't think there's, like, a clear answer in the book as to why they do that. My guess is that it's just, you think it's probably not realistic because the Heat had won, you know, he had a lot of success there, and, like, it's not like the Cavs were unless he obviously he, joke. The Kevin Love stuff impacts this as well, and that gets teased a little bit in this chapter. And we'll get into that more as we kind of go on here, but this is really just like the beginning of what we're seeing with this era. And it's just kind of fascinating to think about how, you know, so much of this is just like occurs in one summer and how many different things really happen here. And there's a whole other, there's so many just crazy alternate timelines with this. You know, one of them is like, does, you know, if David Black comes in and he doesn't have LeBron and Kyrie buys in with him, like, what does that look like? We don't know, but there's just Yeah, there's like, just a lot
Black
of unknowns.
Was vibing with Kyrie, so it's weird. It's all weird to think. And I can't wait to like dissect the David Blatt, like in detail, the David Blatt era, because I have a lot of feelings on it. Just in general, it's a weird time overall.
Yeah, there are some doozy of David Blatt chapters that we will certainly, I think, get into. Evan, any final thoughts as we wrap up here?
It's kind of funny because we're talking about all these coaching candidates. The Nets coaching search right now, which has Kyrie as their point guard and Kevin Durant, you know, a locker room prime for success and good moods all around. Mike Brown is a candidate for the job along with Ty Lue. And I'm just like, you know what? It's just funny how things just work out like that. You know, that's just like kind of what I'm thinking of. And just like more so, I don't know. Like, there's obviously two paths here, but I wonder if the Cavs had a hard commit from LeBron instead of, you know, I mean, Rich Paul did the right thing playing hardball with the Cavs the entire time. Like, I wonder if the Cavs, how many more options they would have for, like, coaching and in terms of trades and stuff, because it wasn't just Kevin Love. Like, LaMarcus Aldridge was on the table as well, too. Like, you wonder, like, what if they traded for LaMarcus Aldridge? Like, there's just so many different crazy scenarios you think about, and, like, from a team building perspective and everything else, just, like, it's just a wild time.
It's an insanely wild time. It's an insanely like weird time in Cavs history, just thinking about everything that happened. The Dan D stuff and that we talked about in chapter one is really wild and kind of fleshes things out quite a bit. The Cal College thing, the money that Calipari wanted and all that stuff. It's just, you know, it's just like a really weird time, and it's a weird era, and it results in something amazing. But the Kyrie stuff, even the, like the contract extension and all that, it's just like a quite, it's quite a weird thing to really think about and dive into as we think mm-hmm. about it. But that it, is going to be it for this week.
Shout out to Sam Vecini on our Fear the Sword. He all did, imagine Vinny Del Negro and Lionel Hollins as the coach of the Cavs instead.
Adrian Griffin was like an option too. Terrifying.
Yeah, no, he's just like, as the kids would say, he's mid. Like, there's no other way to describe VDN. Like, just an incredibly just average coach. Like, we'll get you to a respectable enough level, but will not take you all the way.
Yeah.
And LeBron would have eaten him alive
if he was coaching. It would not have been gone well.
Like, Chris Paul made his life hell. LeBron would have probably made Vinny Del Negro question his entire life.
I can't even imagine any of the college coaches working out, you know, like Hoiberg would have been a mitigated disaster, you know.
I think Coach K could have worked.
But only if LeBron's back. Like, that's the, and even then it's like, I just don't know. Cause he doesn't like, there are just certain things that need to translate. And I you don't know until you know.
Yeah, that's totally fair. And if Coach K was the head coach, guys like would have drafted Jabari instead of Andrew Wiggins, and who knows? Because I feel like a lot of Dukies would be on Cleveland's roster if Coach K was running the show.
Yeah. Or if they take Embiid, I mean, yeah.
Hey, they could have taken Jabari Parker, then Jahlil Okafor the following year, and then I would have been absolutely miserable. So,
my goodness, don't even get me started. Oh my god. Chris Grant could have not been fired or something. I don't even know. There's just
hey Brandon Ingram too. So I guess there's something. Yeah,
imagine they didn't fire Mike Brown. They're just like, we're just gonna keep Mike.
I like Mike. When Golden State was in town, it's funny. Former coaches and executives that have worked with Cleveland kind of run the show behind the scenes, like when the Pelicans were in town, David Griffin was just walking around like by the media room in the Cavs locker, like just walked into the Cavs locker room to go talk with Kevin and a few other players, I heard. And then, like, security was dapping him up. Mike Brown was getting the same treatment. I'm happy for him, and I'm glad he's doing well where he's at now. But, like, I would have slammed my face so hard in my desk right now if Mike Brown was still coaching this team, because, god damn, that was miserable. Like, it didn't make any sense. Like, whatever, man. I think Griffin had a vision, and executed on said vision, obviously, and it all worked out. But, like, just so many weird variables and, like, what ifs and, like, divergent paths and, like, this butterfly effect scenario, like, that could impact where the Cavs went from here. And thankfully, Chris, you and I live in the universe, whatever universe number we're branded with, that ended up with a title in 2016. But, god, it was a lot of weird shit going on behind the scenes.
A lot of weird shit. Exactly. Okay, that's going to be it for this week's episode. Check out our episode with Meredith Minko about the WNBA. Check out our other look backs at the upcoming, the past season, the best moments of the season, and hopefully so far. We have a very cool interview coming on either Monday or Tuesday of next week that we have coming up, but I think you're really going to like. Evan, should we give a hint? Should I drop a tease?
Hell yeah, dude. Well,
okay, so I'll give this a tease. this player played for the Cavs two different times and wore two different numbers.
I can't say it was LeBron. I was going to be really cheeky before you said two different numbers, because that really would have driven our numbers
yes,
up.
Yes, LeBron James coming on Cavs. His first extended interview amid the quarantine. Big breaking news here. Very clutch. It's not LeBron James.
Not at all. We're not. It's going to be a fun interview. We didn't sell our souls.
Yes. Not yet.
Yeah, no, it's going to be a lot of fun.
He's a fan favorite. I think people really like the interview. But before we get out of here on the last segment of today's show, today I wanted to share with you a best of one of our very best programs in the Locked On Podcast Network. Rejecting the Screen has amazing interviews with NBA people, uncovering never told stories or unknown tales of the NBA. You can subscribe to Rejecting the Screen on iTunes, aka Apple Podcasts, or follow on Spotify. So last segment of today's show is a collection of the best of Rejecting the Screen from Noah Kozlov and Adam Stanko. Thanks for listening today. Again, subscribe to that on Spotify or on iTunes. We'll be back next time with more Locked On Cavs. And thanks again for listening.
Hey, it's Noah Kozlov from Rejecting the Screen on the Locked On Podcast Network. Adam Stanko and I get together twice a week to talk hoops with folks who have touched the NBA on all sorts of levels, from all-stars, coaches, executives, and media members. Recently, the number 3 pick in the 2006 NBA draft, Adam Morrison, joined us to tell a story about how Kobe Bryant, his former Lakers teammate with whom he won 2 rings, went above and beyond to lift his spirits.
It was a year after I was out, and so I wasn't playing, obviously, and I was really depressed, and I was basically a hermit in my own house, and didn't go out in the community at all. And you know, if you did, it was one of people asking you, why aren't you playing? And I was, you know, I'm 26 at the time or whatever I was, and, you know, number 3 pick, and just really low point in my life. And I get a text from Robert Lara, the Lakers security, and it was Kobe's, like, one of his best friends. And he said, hey, what's your address? I got something in the mail for you. And I get the package, and it's an autographed jersey from Didier Drogba, who is my favorite player. I'm a Chelsea fan. You know, it was from Kobe. And game-worn jersey, you know, signed Didier Drogba, to Adam, best wishes. And I always thought Kobe, you know, made a phone call, which is would be fine. It's still cool as shit. It's unbelievable. The night he passed, I'm scrolling through, reading everything, and I'm emotional. And on Chelsea's, you know, Instagram page, it's him with Didier Drogba holding up a jersey, and it says, to Adam, best wishes. So he went up to my favorite player, got it signed for me without me even asking, and sent it to me when he knew I was low. That's what Kobe Bryant was, man. He was just one of those dudes who understood his own aura.
When 4-time All-Star Sean Marion hung out with us, not only did he tell us that he tried to recruit Kobe Bryant to the Suns the summer that the Suns ended up signing Steve Nash and Quentin Richardson, he also told us that his 2006 Suns team should have won the title. In the 2011 preseason, his Mavericks teammate Jason Terry was so confident they'd win it all, he got a tattoo of the trophy.
we was at Deshaun Stevenson's house. We had a game in Orlando, and we went to his house, and a few of the team, and we was over having barbecue eating and stuff. And then this tattoo guy came over there, and Jet guy tattooed a trophy on his bicep. I was like, damn, dude. I was like, for real? I was like, okay. I'm loving it. I'm loving the confidence and the swag we have right now. So, like, let alone, don't nobody else in the world know we doing this and we feeling this right now. Because everybody in the league has aspirations. A lot of teams have aspirations to win championships, but it ain't but maybe a handful that actually can do it. You know what I'm saying? So, we was one of those teams. And, like, we're sitting there going through this process and looking at this. And, we was like, yeah.
Did he tell you, hey, I'm going to get a tattoo of the trophy? Did you know as it was happening, or once he got it, he showed you, he's got a tattoo of the trophy?
Well, it was called all kind of one sequence. He's like, we won the championship this year. I'm about to get a trophy right now. I was like, okay. We were like, okay, that's what's up.
I mean,
you don't get no better than that. Come on now. You don't get no better than that.
Yeah, it does it.
You don't get no better than that.
Kevin Willis never did win a ring, but he was an all-star and was one of the most dominant rebounders of his era. He spent year 16 of his career with the Toronto Raptors when Tracy McGrady was in year 2 and Vince Carter was a rookie. As expected, he had some pretty good advice for those kids.
They used to call me OG, old head, things like that. And I think I was in my 15th year or somewhere up in there. And it was like, yeah, man. I used to tell him and T-Mac, I say, T-Mac, first of all, you need to stop falling asleep on the bench and practice. You got to stay awake. You keep falling asleep. But I used to tell him and Vince, you guys rather hope that you get the 15 years because you little snot-nosed rookies. But, you know, they were great, great rookies, great talent.
Speaking of vets and rookies, when Suns legend Eddie Johnson got traded to Seattle, Gary Payton was a rookie point guard, and since everyone loves a good one about GP running his mouth, Eddie delivered.
And I remember one day at practice, I was there for about 2 weeks, and I remember he kept disrupting practice. And Gary's a smart guy. He had a right to talk in that regard because I got to know him. He really knows the game, obviously. He's a Hall of Famer. He's one of the greatest defenders ever now, but at the time, he was a rookie. And rookies were not supposed to talk under my watch.
Right.
So that's what it was for me. And I just couldn't get over the fact that this rookie kept talking, you know, and I let it go for 2 weeks. And I asked Nate McMillan, I said, is it a point in time, man, when you all, like, going to say something to him? And Nate was like, man, you know, Nate kind of shook it off. And I said, well, I'm going to say something. And lo and behold, one practice, he's got the yapping and, you know, coaches going over stuff and he yapping. And I just finally said, would you shut the F up?
About 15 years later in Seattle, PJ Carlesimo was coaching the Sonics with rookie Kevin Durant. When PJ came on the show, he revealed how ahead of the curve his staff was when KD was on the floor.
One good thing we really did with him was we exposed him to a lot of things in terms of we played him at 2, we played him at 3, we played him at 4, we put him in pick and rolls, we encouraged him to shoot threes. It's his only bad three-point percentage. If you look at his percentage year by year in the NBA, it's far and away the lowest one. But again, in those days, it was even a bigger jump from college 3 to NBA 3, and Kevin didn't shoot a lot of threes at Texas, and we had him do that, and at times we were criticized, like, why are they playing this guy at guard? Why are they putting him in pick and rolls? You know, why are they letting him dribble the ball up the court? Because he could.
Staying with coaches, Brendan Haywood won a title with the Mavs in 2011, and when he joined LeBron in the Cavs under David Blatt, it was obvious when a head coaching change was needed.
We could see late in ball games, if he had to draw up plays, we could see he was super nervous. His hands would be shaking. He'd have to give the clipboard to Larry Drew. Larry Drew would draw the plays up. And when you see that, you understand. Like, this dude ain't ready. He's not ready for this. He's not ready for this. And it's not his fault because he thought he was taking on a rebuilding project. And then next thing you know, LeBron James calls up David Blatt and says, I'm coming. And now, instead of taking on a rebuilding project with Kyrie and Deion Waiters at the forefront of it, and Tristan Thompson, you have LeBron James and Kevin Love there, and now you're competing for a title. I think just Coach Blatt got hit with too much too soon, but it was easy to tell right away that Coach Blatt was probably in over his head.
Just like a head coach can lose a team, a woman can tear one apart as well. Butch Beard was an assistant with the Mavericks in the mid-90s as Grammy Award-winning R&B singer Toni Braxton came in between stars Jason Kidd and Jimmy Jackson.
I mean, it ended up being Jason and Jimmy, all right? Jason, Toni. Toni's not caring about either one of them. And then the team was taking sides. So I'll never forget, we had a damn team meeting. And I said, guys, it's a woman that's breaking us apart. And if the woman is that good, please, I want to see what her mother looks like. Because I want to date her mother. Come on.
Entertainment and the NBA will always be intertwined. The first to do that on the media side was the New York Post's Peter Vesey, who was also the sideline reporter for the national broadcasts on NBC. We asked Peter about his post-game interview with Karl Malone after the Jazz lost in the finals to the Bulls in 1997. The YouTube clip is titled, Peter Vesey Tries to Get Punched.
Karl was always a great interview. He would never not answer a question. You know, we really didn't get along. I disliked him on many levels, respected him on many other levels as a player, but, you know, he was a dirty player. And the first time that they showed it to me, I didn't even remember it. Okay. So I did this interview. I had no agenda. I was just going to ask him some tough questions, and I didn't care how tough because I really didn't like him. So, but I knew he was going to answer them. So I didn't feel unsafe. And I didn't feel like I was doing something wrong. And it never dawned on me that came off the way it did. You know, my son would say to me, he said, wow, like, what were you thinking? I said, I was just doing my job. But I had no mindset going in other than I knew he was going to answer my question.
In 1997, former head coach Hubie Brown was broadcasting for TNT, but 5 years later was hired by Jerry West mid-season to coach the Memphis Grizzlies. Point guard Earl Watson was in his second year with the team and was thoroughly confused when it all went down.
Jerry West introduced Hubie. I'm 22 years old. We're in Memphis, losing franchise. First time in my life I've ever been a part of anything that was losing. So it's all new to me. Just everything was like new to me. It almost made me sick. He introduces Hubie Brown and I'm thinking, I got to call Bob because we just hired the TNT guy. This is crazy. I didn't know his full resume, right? So the first thing he says to us, he takes the podium and he says, first I would like to say, you all are fucking losers. None of you are winners. If you was a winner, the other guy wouldn't be packing his stuff with his family, see? You got them fired. You're fucking losers. I'm going to teach you how to be a winner.
The Bob that Earl referred to was Bob Myers, his agent at the time and now the president of the Golden State Warriors. Stories like these are a taste of what rejecting the screen sounds like every week. So we hope you'll join us by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, follow on Spotify, or download and listen wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be right back.